Hello, this is Carsten Klein from Friedrich-Naumann Foundation, and this is Connecting the Dots, a podcast series that tries to bring together voices from Europe and South Asia to have a good conversation on the core values of liberalism and, of course, liberal way of life.
The Ukraine war has upended the standard of living and comfort of Europe, posing the first challenge to the prosperity of the continent. Moreover, it has triggered a series of events that do stand to reshape the very fabric of the region. However, as the dominoes fall, they have an unprecedented effect across the world, challenging energy security in South Asia, with a drastic decrease in purchasing power of the region. What then emerges as the future of energy? Let's listen in. We're joined by my colleague Manjari Mishra and the speakers.
Thank you very much for the opportunity and inviting me for this. I'm Lakmal Fernando from Sri Lanka. I would like to portray myself as an activist of renewable energy, and that's my business too. I run a renewable energy company called Region Renewables, which is one of the largest renewable energy company in Sri Lanka. And on an honorary basis, I work as the chairman of the Renewable Energy Council of National Chamber of Commerce Sri Lanka and a council member of Ceylon Chamber of Sri Lanka in Energy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Jeroen Dobber, and I work for the Brussels office of the Friedrich-Naumann Foundation, where I'm responsible for the Global Security Hub, which is our kind of internal expertise hub for all the work related to security and defense policy. So that's also what I'm specialized in. I've been working quite a lot on European security and defense policy before, but now more and more I also work on the global dimension. And that's why I'm very happy to be here to discuss this topic with you today.
Thank you for being here, Tenzin.
Good morning, and thank you for the invite again. I'm Tenzin Haden, and I'm based in Dharamsala. I work at a research institute. It's called Tibet Policy Institute, based in Dharamsala, and it's affiliated to Central Tibetan Administration. I work there as a research fellow. I look into China's foreign relation, China's diplomacy, China's relation with the U.S. and the Tibet factor, China's relation with India and Tibet issue. So because my background has been international relations as a training, I looked into normative issues in China-EU relations, for instance. So I'm also looking forward to the session.
My first question is to you, Jeroen. What do you think is the biggest challenge for Europe due to the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, we have many, many, many different challenges due to the war. I mean, energy security is definitely one. There are the Ukrainians fleeing from the war, and also in a military sense, there's a big question now. Where armed forces around Europe will have to focus all of a sudden much more on territorial defense again, which is an area that they, I wouldn't say abandoned altogether, but it has definitely not been the focus over the past decades. But I think the most important challenge is to keep internal unity. So Russia's war on Ukraine was universally condemned by EU member states, but there are quite different interests around Europe. So when you talk about energy interests, security interests, political interests, I think all of the challenges that I mentioned before, they can be solved, but only if with Europe, if we kind of stick together. I think that will actually be the main challenge, to keep that kind of unity. So far that has been possible, but as the war keeps going, it will be more and more difficult to keep that level of unity.
I think that has affected Europe very harshly, to be honest, in that manner. But when it comes to the energy crisis and the energy market in South Asia, there has been a shortage of gas. The gas prices are hiking in India, as you guys already know. And also in Sri Lanka, there was a major crisis when it comes to energy shortage. How has it affected Sri Lankan economy and in general the public of Sri Lanka?
Yes. Now, we have been having a very highly fossil fuel biased national grid. If I tell you the numbers, it's about 65% of our energy comes from fossil fuel. Mm-hmm. So naturally, due to the reason, probably the war and even earlier, the COVID-19, so our currency has got devalued drastically. It has got devalued twice. Mm-hmm. And as a result, what we pay for fossil fuel, costs have gone up, doubled, basically. So when this happens, it's automatic that our energy prices are going through the sky, going through the roof, and people have become, very resilient towards this, and it's difficult for them to afford it. Recently, we have one utility. It's a government-owned utility, and they own the entire utility networks and generations and everything they own. Mm-hmm. There are some private power producers, but when you take the scale, it's very low. So majority of generation is owned by the government, and particularly when this happens and when the government utility was losing money due to high energy prices as a result of fossil fuel dependency in the grid, they asked for a 370% price hike. 370% price hike. But we have a regulator called Public Utilities Commission, and Public Utilities Commission allows only reasonable increments that are beyond the controls of the utility. Mm-hmm. So this was not considered as beyond the controls of the utility because they have not delivered the renewable energy targets historically. So it's a failure from the part of the utility. So as a result, they approved only a 75% price hike. This happened about 2 months ago. But a 75% price hike is also a very, very high number when it comes to, a nation that is in poverty. So now, last week, we had another situation. We knew it was coming, but we didn't expect it to be this fast. The parliament has approved another 40% energy price hike in January, and another 40% on top of that in June. So it's happening while we speak, because as much as we get our currency depreciated, and as long as we don't add enough renewables to the national grid, we are going to be speaking about this for the next many decades. Of course, we have set our targets to move into a 70% renewable-based grid in 2030. But how to do this is still questionable, because we haven't seen a proper pathway that's been basically designed and agreed between the utility and the government and the stakeholders yet. Mm-hmm. For example, we create something called long-term generation plan, which is valid for about 20 plus years. The recently developed renewable energy long-term generation plan, not renewable energy, long-term generation plan, has 320 megawatts of emergency power. So, it's very disturbing to see emergency power in a long-term generation plan, because emergency meaning something else. And it's very categorically says these are the emergencies that you can buy emergency power. But in the long-term generation plan, we have emergency power. Mm-hmm. So you can see where it is heading. They bring in beautiful numbers into the long-term generation plan, and they somehow try to minimize the renewables in the national grid. And as a result, we are having eternal price hikes that is completely beyond the control of the country.
Oh, God. I think that has a lot to do with international relations as well, because I, in a way, if we can have a cooperation and a collaboration between countries, I think there is a future for all of the nations in South Asia. Could you comment on it a little? What do you think we can do as a nation, as a region, to be honest?
Sure. I think to begin the conversation with, I think it's important to actually accept the fact that both South Asia, as we are talking about South Asia, and Europe when we are talking about Ukraine crisis, I think there are different perspectives from both these regions.
Hmm.
How do Europeans see Ukraine crisis and how South Asians see the Ukraine crisis? And I think that is the crux of, what do you say, the problem between, you know, European and the South Asian. Because to European, what happens in Ukraine crisis is that humanitarian aspect of the crisis is being shown more often. But to the South Asian, more than the humanitarian crisis, it's more a geopolitical issue to that. So that's always the difference that stands between the South Asian and the European when it comes to Ukraine crisis. Now, coming back to the question that you raised, I mean, there is a huge capability within the region itself, South Asian, because right now when we are talking about energy crisis that rised after Ukraine issue, I think there, what the Europeans are trying to do, not just the Europeans, of course, but other markets also, they're trying to find way, diversify their energy resources to other countries. European officials have visited African countries, to Senegal, to Congo, not just that, but they are finding ways to get energy supply from US, from Qatar, to Norway, right? So I think among South Asians also, when the opportunity comes where Europeans are trying to find other ways of supply and a more cleaner version of that energy supply, like renewable energy. And when we look at South Asia, it has a bountiful of resources when it comes to renewable resources. Look at some of the landlocked countries like Nepal. India is not a landlocked, but India, South Asian countries, Bangladesh, it has a huge reserve of hydropower electricity that it can generate. From Bhutan, yesterday we were saying. So, but South Asian doesn't have the energy, sufficient infrastructure to develop that kind of connectivity among them. So if the South Asians can come together in a way that they can build this connectivity between them and come to a term where they can, you know, negotiate this energy pipeline or the infrastructure, I think it will not just help South Asian economy, to a great level, but it will also help European countries in that sense. Yeah.
Jeroen, do you think there can be any synergies when it comes to basic infrastructures between Europe and South Asia? Can we help each other build a future which is environmentally positive in that manner, very sustainable and renewable?
I think so, but I think then especially on that on the kind of technology part, that will be a very important area, because I think so that connectivity, we also heard that before during the talks at the conference, that that within the South Asian region that will be an important focus area. And actually, the same is true for Europe. There's also a lot of work being done on the connectivity of power grids, because especially with renewables, there are quite a lot of different environments in Europe. And with proper connectivity, you can have a reliable power grid. So that area, I mean, we're both working on that. So any kind of exchange in that area, I think, would be very very fruitful. So there, I see a lot of potential. I don't know if the connectivity, I think that's probably very kind of like a very maybe a very futuristic prospect to have connectivity between South Asia and Europe. I guess for the next decades, that might still be difficult, if that is possible at all. But on the technology front, for sure, any kind of exchange would be very useful.
I think you come from Netherlands, and they have always been big on wind energy. I would say that there is a lot of technology that can be shared,
yeah,
to be honest. Dr. Fernando, do you think, can we get some in a way, technology that is infrastructural help, to be honest, from Europe in that way, and get our resources, because we have abundance of resources, as Tenzin has put it. Do you think there is a possibility to do that?
Yes, definitely. When you look at the Sri Lankan energy space, now Sri Lanka is a country that does not have a lot of resources, financial resources. So in order for us to reach our 70% renewable energy target by 2030, we need, say, approximately about $9 billion. Mm-hmm. Right now, our debt is about, officially about $53 billion and unofficially about $62 billion. So, and our international rankings have dropped drastically. As a result, the lending, per se, for anything is very difficult. So I think the renewable energy development must be looked at outside the standard economics of the country and must be taken off the general day-to-day expenses and whatever the other things that are concerned. So if you are looking at renewable energy development in Sri Lanka, we have identified something like 220 gigawatts of developments. That's massive. What is our requirement for us to reach 70% is about 9 gigawatts. Mm-hmm. That is in combination of about, say, 50% of that coming from wind and 50% of that coming in from solar. Of course, we have things like, you know, mini hydro a little bit that can be developed, and dendro probably a little bit, biomass. But these things are very marginal. Mm-hmm. So if you are speaking about renewable energy, it should be predominantly solar and wind. And this will not become a reality unless otherwise we have some kind of, international intervention in funding for the projects. Because we need, we seriously need low-cost funding. Right now, our treasury bonds are in the range of 28 to 30%. So these numbers are not going to be viable to do renewable energy projects. And that is why I say that we need long-term funding, particularly, you know, reserved for renewable energy. And having said that, I'm not going to limit ourselves to this 9 gigawatts. We are looking at, as a country, we need to look at green hydrogen. And of course, interconnection between Sri Lanka and India, so that bilateral energy exchange can take place. And that's going to be the future, because then the lot of expansions that are supposed to be done in the national grid can be minimized. Mm-hmm. Because then this imbalance, energy imbalance, can be controlled if you can do that. So these things have been in discussion for a fairly longer time, but haven't seen the daylight yet. So I think it is time for us to actually hit the ground zero and do something about it. Because we are not speaking about large numbers when it comes to an economy of, say, India's nature. We are speaking about to do a layer HVDC cable of 50 to 55 kilometers HVDC cable. It's about $350 million. And if you are going to be upgrading it to a 2 MVA, so that will cost about, say, approximately about $1.2 million.
That's
very marginal compared to the scale of business that we can do between two countries and the stability that we can bring into the region in terms of renewable energy generation. Now, why we are facing this turmoil today is we are too much dependent on fossil fuel, which we don't have. Luckily enough, to India, you have your coal resources, again, depleting. You are coaling down, you are closing down coal mines and closing down coal plants. Adani is, is closing down their Australian plant 10 years earlier. So, I mean, the energy giants are changing their attitude towards energy. Mm. So they are moving towards renewables, and we can't get out of it. We are a part of it, and we will have to promote it. So as long as we rely ourselves on renewable energy, As a world, we will survive, and if not, we all will sink.
I think that is the way forward, and I'm pretty sure that has a lot to do with international relations and public policies, and I know, Tenzin, that the expertise will be coming from you. Do you think when it comes to energy security, should we cross our political barriers and be united as one world, one in that globalized world?
We were discussing earlier about not just about energy crisis, but energy crisis happened today. But there are humanitarian crises for over how many decades, right? Have we been united on these issues, about human rights issues, about refugees? You know, there are issues beyond energy, beyond resources, but we have never unified. But now I think it's not just about energy crisis, you know, it's what is happening inside Ukraine to Ukrainian people. And I think it's important that, you know, I won't say to find a high ground, you know, highway sort of like high ground. But I would say, despite what has happened between the European countries and the South Asian, despite their differences in the level of interactions and the relations they have with Russia, I think it's important to come to terms that what is happening in Ukraine can happen anywhere. I mean, today it's Ukraine. It was before it was Crimea. We saw that already. And I would like to point it out that six decades earlier, it was Tibet.
Exactly.
And maybe 10, 15 years later, which country will it be, right? So in that sense, territorial integrity that we have invested so much and believed in so much, I mean, it has come into terms that people now question that very sovereignty that we believed in. So I think from international relations point of view, I think it's highly important and necessary for countries, especially smaller countries in that time, South Asian countries, to come together and, you know, form a sort of a unanimous opinion about it and bring a sort of a policy that is not just that does not just address the energy crisis that we are having right now, but issues that has been there for a very long time, along with energy crisis, along with Ukraine crisis, the humanitarian crisis, the human rights issues, you know. So I think that in that way, if the South Asians can come together to form a long-term sort of policy, that wouldn't just help South Asian, but it might help the Europeans to form some sort of like a, you know, like a solution for them.
And I have a question now, Jeroen, to you. Since we are talking a lot about the issues that are beyond energy crisis, but at the same time, energy crisis has made us think about the security issues in countries in general, and specifically towards free market economy, because as you all have put it forward, we need to diversify when it comes to our economy as well, regardless of our energy resources or otherwise. So what do you think? My question is actually to all of you. What do you think is the future when it comes to stabilizing, not only stabilizing, but progressing towards a future which is much more sustainable and healthier for the whole population? Because at the same time, I mean, if we look at Europe and South Asia, two different regions, two different worlds separated from each other from on a long distance, we are facing the same energy crisis, heat waves coming in, not energy crisis, but like environmental crisis, sorry. Heat waves coming in Europe, us facing the same extremities, Pakistan having floods, India having really bad heat waves in general. So what do you think can be the future of economy, sustainability in both the regions? Would you like to start, Jeroen?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the environment topic, because that is something that kind of, it's a challenge for all of us. So that's something that it can either kind of create a divide, or it can bring us together somehow if we take on that challenge. And it's also one area where from the European side there is a very clear interest to work together with the South Asian region. I think electricity demand here is expected to double by 2050. So if that comes from coal and fossil fuels, I mean, that will have a massive impact on the global environment, but that will also have a big impact then on Europe, which is working hard on reducing its own emissions. I mean, we're all trying that, but if it increases even further, I mean, we just make the problem bigger and bigger. So there is a big incentive or a big interest from the European side to get involved in that. I think that can also be a kind of that can be an area that brings us, but maybe also with other regions in the world, that kind of that could potentially bring us together somehow. Yeah.
Do you have any comment on that?
Yes. You know, the global warming has become an issue to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
North Pole and South Pole, we see the glaciers melting, and it's devastating results right in front of us. As Jerome very clearly said, that the energy demand is going to get doubled, and as long as we try and stick to renewables, we are going to add another centigrade day probably every year into the atmosphere. So it's not going to work. But equally, now, there is something that each one of us can do. Say, like curtailing, limiting your consumptions. That should start at your home.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of looking at it. Because now, I when I walk out of my room, I always switch off my lights, switch off my AC. That should start at home, and we should, as a not-for-profit organization, I think FNF should give some kind of an input to the grassroots level for people to think energy efficiently. So probably everyone might not have enough money to move into renewable energy, but they can contribute in their own way by limiting the consumption. That's one way of looking at it. And on the other hand, why we are speaking about global warming today? Because we have taken things for granted. We have taken things for granted. We have used them extensively. When I travel in the, you know, Norway and Scandic countries, I can see even during the daytime, outside lights are also on. Because electricity was so cheap. Now it is not like that. This is about, say, 4 or 5 years ago. Now electricity pricing there is also on par with the region. But the resources were available. Their hydro resources were massive. Their wind resources were massive. And since it was there, free of charge, kind of, it's almost free of charge, people were not concerned about it. But we all should be concerned about it. So, and the countries who have contributed to the global warming in a big way must contribute to getting it out of our equations as well, in a big way. And those funding should be used to deploy renewable energy in poorer nations. Say, for example, now, who are the bigger producers in the world? Europe is a very big producer in the world. China is a very big producer in the world. And USA is a very big producer in the world. So these are very few to name, but there are many others. So these countries must contribute by law. We should bring in some laws to these countries to contribute towards the poorer nations' renewable energy development.
Mm.
Because they can't afford it. As I said, now we need $9 billion. We can't afford it. But now these things should come from other countries who have attributed to this damage that they have done to the world and must pay for it.
Mm.
And it should be, you know, in some form, it should be legalized. Say, we can very easily determine what kind of damage that they have done by looking at the carbon emissions that each and every production facility has put into the atmosphere. So by way of doing that, like the same thing now, when somebody is importing something to a country, there is a tax. So it should be engrossed in that price and paid for.
So you're proposing a carbon emission tax, to be honest, in that manner?
Carbon emission tax for the producers who have basically violated the environment in big time. Because it's very easy for somebody to, you know, do everything, and all of a sudden, after making all the money from the consumers, all of a sudden they can wake up and say, look, from tomorrow I'm going to be renewables, and all you guys also will have to be renewables. If not, I'm imposing tax on you. That's wrong. If he is the originator of the system who have violated the rights of the people of this world, he should pay first. Then comes the others.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And do you have anything to say to it? Because I think in that way, it's a lot connected with humanitarian crisis as well.
Of course. I totally agree with the renewable energy because, I mean, you were asking about a sort of like a better future, a sustainable future, a stable future. And I think one very important component in it is environment itself. And that is why we were all talking about renewable energy, to tap in the renewable energy, to access, to have access, to have infrastructure to actually use those renewable energy sources. And I think, but again, it's easier said than done, because these resources are spread across global unevenly. And, you know, some of those resources and reserves are in countries where you don't have, you know, like, you don't have proper relations with. For instance, China has almost, like I was telling yesterday, that China has almost a monopoly, near monopoly over its solar energy. And when European countries and South Asians are in search of diversifying or in search of other alternative energy sources, right? And the Europeans don't even have the resources, first of all. And second of all, they don't have the infrastructure to process that resource. So in order for Europeans to actually build that infrastructure will take years to even accomplish that. So where does it leave the European in terms of their relations with China? And in that context, Ukraine crisis, in that context, Russia. So it all comes back to geopolitical again. Whether you say humanitarian issue or not, one or the other way, it goes back to the geopolitical issues as well. So I think when we were asking about a stable and a sustainable future, also we have to take into account, especially after the Ukraine crisis, that the economic landscape has always been fragile and unstable, and Ukraine crisis could not be a more better example than that. Not just that, but politically highly divided among each other. Look at the discussion we are having right now, from the Europeans to the South Asians to the Southeast Asians, who actually did not vote against Russia. Why is that? Because Russia is the biggest arms supply for the Southeast Asian country, except Singapore.
Yeah.
Now, what does it say? Where does it leave the country? So these are not just questions, but these are not new questions. I keep saying that. It has been there for so many years, but we still somehow come back to the same issue again and again, right? So how do we find a solution on that?
That's actually, I mean, we are running in circles at this point, to be honest. But the only way forward is in that manner, with these kind of dialogues where experts like all of you can come together, talk about it, and enlighten us with all these kind of information. And I think a few takeaways for me here is that there is always more space for debating and discussions to come together and to solve the problem. At the same time, now it's the time to act. We are not acting enough. We are not being active enough in changing the scenario in the whole world. And we are paying the price for it. So, yeah, thank you so much, all of you. If you have any comments on today's session, please go ahead.
It's quite interesting. I think we should try and perceive on what I just proposed. Because it's important to understand the economic viability of each and every project what is in front of us, and the affordability of different countries for such projects. We may have, you know, all kinds of abundant resources in our respective countries, but when it comes to affordability, we all have massive challenges ahead of us. So I think it's time for us to talk about the affordability issues and funding issues when it comes to particularly the South Asian region. And give solutions by way of the scaling that the people have done, the damage that they have done to the world so far. Mm. Not the future, the past. We have to evaluate the past and base our funding lines on the past damage, whatever they have done to the world. Then we will be able to, you know, find a solution, because if not, poorer nations will only be having ideas and will be talking about it without doing anything about it, and they will get poorer and poorer every year, because we can't get enough renewables to our grids because we don't have money.
Yeah, I would like to, like, as a kind of final comment, maybe echo some of the things that you were saying before, that I think everything seems to be very connected, but it's also all in flux. Everything, the everything is moving, I have the feeling. There's the humanitarian dimension, things are happening that from a European point of view we never thought would happen again. There's the energy transition or energy security issues, the geopolitical changes. So everything is moving. And I think a lot of countries who've been kind of sitting on the fence have been forced to affiliate themselves, or there's more and more pressure on that. So for instance, with Sweden and Finland joining NATO now, I think that's a nice example of countries who thought they could kind of disengage in some of these discussions, but because of this situation, they've been forced to take a stance. And I think that will be the situation for more countries as time goes on, that it will be necessary to have a clearer position. It's difficult to maintain that position of not getting engaged anymore. So there, I'm very curious how that will work out. And I think these kind of conversations are indeed very important to exchange ideas about that. And I hope that as many countries as possible will kind of align with the liberal democracy agenda, and hopefully we can form a powerful bloc there against the forces who think otherwise.
Thank you.
Yeah, my sort of last comment, I would like to go back to my training, international relations student and a Chinese division as well. So I wanted to bring one last thing about how Beijing might play its role in its future relations with South Asia and Europe after the Ukraine crisis. And I say this because very recently Joseph Borrell, who stated very clearly that the Europeans have depended on U.S. so much on their defense and military, that the Europeans have depended so much on China and Russia on the economic and prosperity, and which has did what? Nothing good, right? So you always need to stand up for yourself. That's what he was saying, right? So I think it's not just that. It's also because China has predominantly became a sort of like a strategic rivalry for the Europeans. The European Commission stated in 2019. So it's not just about the rivalry between China and Europe, but it has more to do with who has sort of like the biggest say, not just in Europe, but in South Asia as well. How much China has stake in, say, in Sri Lanka's relation with Russia or with China? Like Maldives has a much bigger relation, has a much important relation to China than Russia. India, for example, you may say it's a friendship relation between Russia and India, but but China and Russia has a no limit partnership, they True. Recently declared. So where does it leave? I mean, even after the Ukraine crisis, who suffers the most? Of course, the Ukraine people and Russia as well, and Europe and South Asia. But who gets the most out of it? I won't say Beijing, but who will get the most out of it? It's still a question. And I think Beijing will continue to play a huge role after this, not just in South Asia, to Southeast Asia, in Europe, in changing the whole global politics. And it will be, I won't say interesting, but it will be, I don't know, maybe sad to see that happening in near future. So I would say FNF maybe in their next conference, I think it's highly important for you to organize such event on what will be Beijing's role in the after Ukraine crisis.
I'm looking at Defense Cafe here.
A
topic.
And, and when you bring the dots, you know, China is actually connecting all the dots from South Asia to Europe to everywhere.
That's very interesting to see.
Yeah, and nobody is pointing it out. So it felt like an elephant in the room. But I'm doing that, so
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for such good conversation. And it lasted longer than I expected. That means it was very interesting for me, at least. It was very enlightening. And yeah, I'm glad to have you all here today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Carsten Klein from Friedrich-Naumann Foundation. And this is Connecting the Dots. Thank you and have fun.